This is Stephen Fry, and you're listening to Stephen Fry's Podgrounds. This podgram discusses the pitfalls, not to say pratfalls, of Amazonian exploration. I suppose to some extent I had suspected something would go wrong with this year, the year that I'm calling 2007, although it leaked out into 2008, rather in the way that years will, not respecting calendars. It began as brightly and hopefully as a year could begin, really, in as much as I was very busy and I enjoy being busy. I think it began with something called Bones, an American TV series. I did three or maybe four episodes of Bones in January 2007, and then leapt across to Budapest, and thence to Malta to do a part in a film about Eichmann. And that was very merry, and I enjoyed that very much, and thought it was a good way of stretching my muscles and bracing up for what I knew was going to be a long and complicated year. I then stopped acting a bit and got my head down and did some writing. I wrote a screenplay, the first draft of a screenplay for the New Zealand filmmaker Peter Jackson, who's producing a new film on the story of the Dam Busters raid of 1943, the famous raid on the great dams of the Ruhr in Germany, made inexhaustibly and joyously famous to all British and colonial audiences, really, since 1954, through the original Dam Busters film, the Michael Anderson film with the great Michael Redgrave and Richard Todd, amongst others, playing Barnes Wallace playing Barnes Wallace and I do this sometimes, playing Barnes Wallace and Guy Gibson, respectively. Anyway, diversions are beginning to sort of seed and thicken themselves in the garden of this little podcast, and I don't want it to become quite overgrown yet. I have a clear story to tell, and there's nothing to stop me getting on with it. I wrote the first draft, then started writing a second draft while doing a series I do called QI, 12 episodes of QI. That's based in London. And in the days when I wasn't doing QI, I was zooming around England meeting old survivors of the original Dam Busters raid and people connected with survivors and building towards a second draft, which I managed to write. And then, of course, I had to write something else, which was a pantomime for the Old Vic Theatre, which had been commissioned by Kevin Spacey, who runs the place, a little earlier. And I knew the only time I had to finish it was around this period. So I betook myself so to do and managed to deliver that more or less on time. But then I had to zoom off to Norfolk to do 3 months of filming for the second series of a drama show I do called Kingdom. And in the middle of that, I also played Malvolio in a live performance of Twelfth Night and enjoyed the ignominy of my 50th birthday, which was broadcast in odd ways around Britain. And as soon as Kingdom finished at the end of September, I girded my loins and did my packing and made ready to go to America, because that was the great purpose of this third, if you like, third of the year, was to make a documentary in which I visit every single state of the Union, every 50 states in America, to make a film, a series of five films in which I try and capture some sense of the spirit of America from the point of view of its states, not of its great cities, not of its great political movements, not necessarily of its great landscapes or its great history or political or social, cultural, musical or any other energies, so many of those as there have been, and so powerful they have been, and so indeed looked into they've been. But the actual nature of America as an agglomeration of states interested me enormously. Difference between the states, the sort of sense of identity that each state's member has of him or herself. And it seemed a wonderful way to journey around a country that endlessly fascinated me. We were to do five films. The first took me down the coast of New England from Maine all the way down, really almost down to the Mason-Dixon line to Pennsylvania and across to Maryland and Washington, D.C., which, of course, isn't truly a state. Then The second film was The True South, really, right down through the Carolinas and Georgia and Alabama, West Virginia, Virginia, Tennessee, Kentucky and Florida. Wonderful and extraordinary experience. And then Christmas came and I managed to sneak a week or so away with friends. And then I had to start another documentary. This is a documentary about disappearing mammals, inspired by a book written by Douglas Adams, an old friend of mine, a wonderful friend, greatly funny comic writer, and his friend, Mark Carwardine, a zoologist, a scientist, a man who knows about the animals. And 25 years ago, they embarked on a trip around the world to try and find some of the most endangered species there were and to see what was being done to save them, and even possibly to recognise that nothing could be done to save them, that they would be the last people to see them. And it struck Mark and myself as interesting and worthwhile to look at what had happened 25 years later. In some cases, some species have absolutely been wiped from the face of the earth. In others, they've been spectacularly saved. I think it tells us a lot about what hopes we may have for the next 100 or so years as we continue to try and cohabit the planet with the bewildering array of species that surround us and occasionally impinge upon our lives, but most often try and fly, swim, crawl, burrow their way as far from us as they possibly can, because they're not foolish. So, the first of these programmes, after Christmas, was to take me to Brazil, where we were to look at the manatee, essentially, this marvellous aquatic mammal shaped in a sort of shiny vinyl suit, a bit like an ectoplasmic blob, a beautiful thing with keen eyes, a mammal, as I say, suckles its young under the water, lives in murky waters in the Amazon, and is very hard to see ever. It just raises two tiny little nostrils above the surface of the water from time to time, and otherwise is down there nibbling like a sort of sea cow. In fact, it's called a sea cow in Brazilian, in Portuguese. That's its name, or a sea fish at least, a fish cow, I should say, peixe de boia. Peixe de boia is fish cow. So they're inoffensive things, like most vegetarians. They just nibble. And we were hunting them, not ruthlessly, but to try and capture them on camera. That's as far as we've got to January the something like the 10th, I think it must be. And this is where my voice takes on a slight catch, because I'm getting terribly nervous to recreate this accident. It sounds pathetic to do so. It's a strange thing. All this time, I've built up a story of this work I'm supposed to be doing and had supposed to be doing all the way through 2007, and I realised it was, you know, the contingencies were very tight, the margins for error, very, very tight, and that mistakes could be made rapidly. An injury would naturally be one of the things that beat its wings over the head, and one would try not to listen to the idea of it, instead poo-pooing this whole notion of health and safety. And yet, you know, when you're in unfamiliar territory and there's unusual diseases and unusual parasites and dangerous animals and boats and things like this, that there's always the possibility that one small, unforeseeable, preposterous moment could propel one's life into a dizzying vortex of despair, pain, ruin, disappointment, bitterness, and gall. Should I go that far? Well, the morning dawned in Tefé, which is a pretty remote place. These parts of Brazil tend to use as their units of measurement days rather than hours or kilometres or miles. So things are two or three days away from each other. And Tefé is a few days from Manaus, which is a large city right in the middle of Amazonia. And in Tefé, we were going to go onto the Solimões, which is the name, actually, the Amazon River takes in that part of the country. And we were going to take a young bred manatee and introduce him into a smallish artificially created pen within the river in order to acclimatize him, habituate him to the nature of living in a river and foraging for himself. But he'd been bred in captivity and lived in sort of baths, essentially, where he'd been charmingly looked after and tickled. But it was time he got experience of living in a river. So we got up at 5 in the morning and took a small boat from the beach or side or bank of the river to a sort of floating harbour where the larger boat, where Peche, the manatee, was in his grand bath, and we, that's myself, director, sound and camera and assistant producer, and the people who are to do with the project of releasing and habituating the manatee, were all gathered and ready to go off on a 3-day river voyage to the place where Peche should be freed. I got out of the leading boat first and walked quickly round the corner to where the large boat was. It was by this time something like, I would say, 5:45 in the morning. We're very close to the equator in this place I'm describing, and as you may know, in the equator, all year round, essentially, the sun rises at 6 and sets at 6. The days are equal. 12 hours of daylight and 12 hours of darkness, and so it was quarter to dawn, if you like, and still dark. I rounded the corner, and there's a gap between the dock and where the boat was. There must be a gap of needs, unless you have a dock that's exactly the same size as the keel and hull of the boat, which is obviously impossible. And I just, my foot went down into that gap, and my body did the rest without my thinking. It lurched and spiraled and tottered and heaved in a presumably a blind, scrabbling panic. I don't really remember that. In order to get purchase on something rather than just go plunging down between boat and dock into the icy waters of the Solimush below. And somehow I contrived to slam the whole weight of my body, which is not inconsiderable, 18.5 stone at the very least at that point, I think, right against the railing of the larger boat, and A dreadful snapping right inside me. And I was held on to it. I was clutching it, going, screaming for help, because I knew I had to be taken off the boat, that otherwise my weak arm would loosen it and I'd slide down into the water. Kind people came around the corner and somehow got me off the boat, me screaming all the more as they handled my arm. And I think I managed to sound reasonably sentient. I said I thought I'd dislocated my shoulder, which was my first feeling, partly because of the noise and the general thing of it. And I knew that dislocated shoulders did create huge amounts of noise and were very painful. It was decided it wasn't a shoulder as I lay there, painkillers being given to me from our BBC Medipacks. Anyway, to cut out what is obviously already a very long story, a little bit mercifully shorter, medical people came, and within half an hour I was in a tiny little hospital in Tefe having an x-ray. We were very impressed they had an x-ray machine. And we saw a large break, and there was much talk of how it was going to have to be hammers and nails and screws and plates and things. And they put a cast on me very expertly, and an aeroplane was booked to take me to Manaus, the largest city in Amazonia, which was a sort of 2.5-hour flight by flying boat, and the flying boat had to leave Manaus, so it was a kind of 5 hours from what this time was, I think about 9. So we reckoned that I'd be in Manaus by about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and that in the afternoon, I beg your pardon, and that whatever operation was necessary would be done there. So, really whimpering like an awful old coward, I eventually got onto this plane, and the ducking and everything else, I can't tell you how horrible it was. And we bounced along the air and arrived at Manaus, and then I was bounced from one hospital to another. They agreed that I should have pins and screws, but that I should also have blood tests and various other tests in order to show that I was ready and fit and able to have the operation. Such was Brazilian law. Meantime, it seems, just as I got all those pieces of paperwork together by shuttling from one hospital to another and standing in queues for hours and hours on end, meantime, the BBC's insurance people had decided that actually they didn't want me operated on in this way in Manaus, and that I should be flown to Miami the next morning. So I had one night in Manaus, agonizing night. It was impossible to get out of bed without screaming. In fact, the screaming was like the jet propulsion that got me out of bed. In order to get out of bed, I would push my head back into the pillow and then utter a loud scream that pushed me up, 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 and got weight on both legs. Then I could totter forward and do whatever it is I needed to do. Flight to Miami was horrific. I had to have the plaster cast that they'd kindly put on in Tefe, had to have that sawn off at high speed because apparently, under some regulation or other, a fresh plaster cast could not be taken on board an aeroplane for security reasons. I go figure. There was a gun hidden in it, I don't know. Anyway, so that had to happen, and that was all very miserable. Arrive in Miami, screeching. By this time, it's a Friday. It happened screeching in the afternoon to the Mount Sinai Hospital, where the triage, which is what Americans call sort of admission process, takes place. And eventually, I have to say, x-rayed again. And unfortunately, we lost the original x-rays that had been taken in Tefe. And these x-rays basically told the doctor and the consultant who saw them remotely by email that there was nothing too much to worry about, that all I needed was some sort of tubular brace applied to my upper right arm and that it would heal itself splendidly. So I had a weekend on South Beach hanging around for my consultation on the Monday, and I went in and he indeed stuck by his story, the consultant, and said that's all that was necessary, that I should go and see an orthotician who would make me one of these little braces, and then I could go home. So that duly happened. On a Tuesday, I was flying back to London, British Airways. I managed to get an appointment with a British consultant, orthopaedic surgeon, who was an expert in the upper arm, for Friday. And in the meantime, the tube stayed on me, and I have to say, I was more or less in pretty dreadful pain, and thinking myself a terrible weasel and having such a low pain threshold and being such a wimp and making such a fuss about what was clearly just an ordinary broken arm, and there were people pouring off aeroplanes from the skiing airports of Europe with snapped legs and arms who were cheerfully wandering around thinking it was all a great joke. So why was I so sort of pale and pained and unhappy? Then I saw the consultant and he gave me an x-ray. And it was a proper x-ray, and I could see that the damn thing was extraordinarily bad break. It was a spiral fracture with a great big gap, through which, it turned out, the radial nerve was threaded like some errant piece of spaghetti. And one sharp move from me, and it could have snapped that radial nerve. It could have sheared it in twain like a pair of secateurs. So that was deeply worrying, that you know, I potentially could have lost all use of my right hand for the rest of my life, just by a casual cough or hauling of the shoulders. Anyway, he said, no, you really do need surgery, and you need plates and screws and things. This is a massive fracture. He was pretty astonished that I'd have been all the way around Brazil and up to Miami and all the way back again without it being made plain to me that that was the only possible outcome. So he booked me in for Monday. This was still a Friday, so I had a weekend of hanging around, and eventually on Monday he goes in and I have an operation. It's a four-hour operation, and I wake up in appalling pain, thinking, oh God, things, everything's worse. But of course, actually, what happens in these operations is you're hauled about pretty unceremoniously, and you lose an astonishing amount of blood that goes to your elbows and other joints and swells up, and things are very, very sore indeed. It's now exactly a week since I was released from hospital, and I'm hoping and praying I'm going to be allowed to go to America to carry on with the third leg of the American documentary, New Orleans to the Great Lakes. I still am in some pain. My voice to you might sound woozy. That's because I've just taken sleeping pills. I've decided instead to send you this message. I'm finding sleep and everything else very difficult. I'm finding it very difficult to write with my right hand. I'm finding it very difficult to pick things up and put them down. I'm finding it very difficult to concentrate. I'm finding it very difficult to suffer the pathetic humiliation and mortification and damnable inconvenience and discomfort of being in this state. There's nothing to moan about. I'm perfectly healthy. I'm not ill in any way. It's just mechanically I probably need a month and a half of heavy physiotherapy and doing nothing else. And in my life, I do not have a month and a half to take out. Now, many people will hear that and say that that is the babblings of an idiot. Anybody should respect their health first. Well, after all, we work to live, we don't live to work. No, not I fear. I fear that I live to work. And the idea of letting down the schedule of this series, which then we'll have to morph into the next series of further animals and things as I go on doing documentaries right up until through 2009, the third series of Kingdom and another series of QI, and so on, all these are kind of set and people are dependent upon them. The idea that I would have to throw that up in the air or to make that more difficult for everybody and to, you know, for the hotels and the interviewees that we're going to see on our journey to have to be told, you know, can you make next week instead or the week after? I don't know. None of it's insuperable. None of it's terribly serious. It's just a broken arm in a big world where, you know, columns of molten lava are being thrown up in the air, where children are being abused and villages burned and whole communities raped, and injustice and terror and misery are being sown everywhere around us as we speak. People are dying for not enough to drink, not enough to eat. People are dying for ingesting the wrong things, for taking drugs. People are stabbing each other. People are losing their loved ones. People are missing opportunities for their lives to be happy. And all I have is a snapped arm in the very height of the 21st century's brilliant ability to mend such things. And yet I'm feeling as if somehow I've been betrayed and had something snatched and stolen away from me. It's pathetic of me. I'm fully aware of it. I'm not asking for sympathy or to be told that it's natural for me to feel like this. It's just something to contemplate. How can it be that I can be so upset, annoyed, and feel so robbed of a short number of weeks? It terrifies me that tomorrow when I see the consultant, he'll tell me not to go to America, that I need more time. Anyway, I thought I'd keep you apprised. This isn't necessarily the kind of blessing that you can expect over the next few, however long it is. It all comes straight from the throat. It's not edited, and so it's probably repetitious and dull. I hope it would be a little sparkier and a little more informative, a little more colourful, a little more delightful, a little more structured, a little more narrative, if you like, a little more suspenseful. A little more enjoyable. Well, let's be honest, I hope it'll be a little bit better next time. This is very much an opening salvo, and I enjoy the radio feeling of talking just to you. And I hope you enjoy the feeling of listening to it. It's 22 minutes so far, and I shan't make it stretch much further than that, but at least now it's a good walk. So if you're doing some sort of exercise regime, any doctor will say a brisk walk of 22 minutes is a good thing for everyone to do once a day. So if you do a brisk walk to this, that will have served its purpose, no matter what words have been heard. It is only the story of a large, overweight Englishman trying to go round a boat and breaking his arm. That's really all there is. There's nothing, there's no philosophy, there's no history, there's no social truth to be extracted from that melancholy experience. It is what it is. But for all that, I am the one to whom it happened, and I have, in our extraordinary new world, the technology and the bandwidth and the opportunity to give you 23 minutes worth now of information about it. That's enough for this first little podcast. In case you need to know, there are pictures available on the site of the break itself and of the pins and the screws. I will let you know what the doctor says to me tomorrow. I'm not in a cast. The whole point of having these plates and pins is that it doesn't need a cast, so my arm is free to swing, though it's often in a sling because it's uncomfortable straight down and it's still a bit stiff, and I'll need to do lots of exercises. That's it. Less self-pity, I hope, in future. But it's been tremendous fun talking to you. And thanks for listening for all this time. Bless you all. And until the next time. Until the next time we meet over the air. Goodbye. been listening to Stephen Fry. For more podcasts, bloggery and blessés, visit stephenfry.com.